Peterson. For many Americans, pensions are a thing of the past, and that puts pressure on us to fund our own retirement. Just plain old non-retirement saving puts pressure on us. Higher risk investments were crushed by stock market drops over the past decade, so people turn to lower risk investments like money market accounts, bond holdings, and certificates of deposit. But now those investment vehicles and others are at modern time lows. So what's a person to do? Well, the Cash Money crew joins us to talk about current conditions and alternate options that you might want to consider. It's Central Standard after this hour's news from NPR. Whether you're an older, high-income earner near retirement or a younger, lower-income wage earner funding your retirement, the current marketplace is a challenge. That's probably an understatement, especially if you are risk-averse and determined to invest conservatively. Yields are at modern-day lows, and in many cases, your investment portfolio, after fees and inflation, could be losing money. An article on WallStreet.com points to a recent study that lists certain bond returns at minus 1.4% a year. Not so good. I'm Bill Anderson. This is Central Standard. Many people don't have company-supplied pensions, and Social Security is looked upon with a wary eye. In fact, it was really designed to not provide all the money we need in our retirement. So what do we do as we look at the low returns, the low yields? Do we stop, go, or yield the right of way to riskier investments? Our Cash Money crew has the answer, I hope. Today's version of the Cash Money crew, Alex Petrovic, certified financial planner with Petrovic Financial Services.
Good morning, Bill.
Welcome back. Lucas Butchel is here. He's from KHC Wealth Management.
Great to be back, Bill. Thank you.
And David Jackson, a certified financial planner with Waddell & Reed. Also, I must add, a graduate of Sioux Falls University and a football and track star, David?
I don't know about the star part, but yes.
Oh, my, the glory days. It's amazing what one can find on the internet.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Let's start with you, David. Kind of give us, kind of summarize what we're looking at here and kind of frame this hour's broadcast.
Okay. Well, let's just think about what we went through in 2008. You know, we went through the worst economic decline since the Great Depression. So the economy was in terrible shape. And the Fed has said, hey, we need to stimulate the economy. One of the ways to do that is to lower interest rates. Now, interest rates are two sides of the same coin. You know, if you're a borrower, low interest rates is a bonanza for you. You know, it makes it easier to buy a house, it's easier to buy a car. If you're a business owner and you need to expand, it makes it easier to finance that business. But if you're a saver, you're stuck with really low interest rates. And so let's think about the guy who's done a really good job of saving for retirement. He's accumulated, let's say, $500,000 for retirement.
Right.
He's retired, and he has a CD that was paying 5% interest for him. Mm-hmm. So he's getting about $25,000 a year off of that CD, plus his Social Security, which might be another $15,000. So that's about $40,000 a year of income for him.
Right.
Well, when his CD matures and he's only going to get 1% interest on it, that $25,000 a year now goes down to $5,000 a year.
Yeah.
So that, you know, so now his income's been basically cut in half. So what does a guy do then? You know, if he's been told that, you know, when you retire, you stay really conservative with your investments.
Yes.
And all of a sudden the conservative investments aren't paying any money, but he still needs the $40,000 a year he was getting. So we've got a lot of people out there that are in this dilemma now. It's like, okay, how do I make up that 5% that I was earning? And you're going to have to take some risks to get it.
Well, let's talk, and Lucas, I'll turn to you now. What kind of investment vehicles are we looking at here? What was David referencing there?
He was talking about a certificate of deposit, which is a CD that you'd buy at a bank or credit union. It's a safe investment guaranteed by the FDIC. And so these are fixed rate investments, but with the low interest rate environment now, the institutions are offering a lot less interest than they have in the past.
Mm-hmm. And what are some other instruments that we'll probably be talking about over the course of this hour?
typical savings accounts, so you know, an account that is also with a bank that pays an interest rate. And then we'll also talk about some alternatives that are getting talked about and getting read about a lot that we'll talk about the pros and cons of. These will be things like bonds, which would be either short-term or long-term. There's also dividend-paying stocks, which which kick off some income. And then there's some other more unique, more complex investments like master limited partnerships, certain annuities, and some other kind of mutual fund type things that kick off income.
Well, Alex, let's take this guy who has $500,000, and at one point in time he's in retirement, so he's being taking a conservative position because he doesn't want to ride the highs and lows of the stock market, wants to play it kind of conservatively so that money continues to flow and generate some level of income. But then suddenly, as David said, he's earning 1%. What's he going to do? Is it in his best interest just to ride it out and stay put?
Well, first of all, you know, if we were engaging him as a client, we would try to look at the overall picture. Is this all he owns? Mm-hmm. Is just this bond portfolio or the CD portfolio? Or is in the larger context of a portfolio that owns both guaranteed bonds and stocks? And that's how we would try to have approach it, because if the bonds aren't doing so well, as we know, the stock market's having a great year. Mm-hmm. But if he has just been in fixed income, and that fixed income and hasn't benefited from the stock market, then we've got the real dilemma. What does he do? And right now, and as the Fed has told us, probably rates are not going up until 2015, then he's got one of two choices: stay put, take less vacations or something of that nature, cutting expenses, or move up the ladder in terms of risk, which for most of us, that first ladder would be, you know, short-term bonds, either taxable or tax exempt, depending on his situation. But you know, as financial planners, we always kind of pride ourselves that we can fix everything.
Yeah.
There's certain things you can't fix.
Right.
You know, and this is one of them. I mean, if they do not want more risk, you can't fix that.
Yeah.
So, and it's not our job to convince them that they should take more risk. So we're in that, that time frame right now, that patience, if you're a non-risk investor, may be one of your best choices.
Lucas.
When I talk about this with folks, I think it's really important to delineate what the purpose of the money is for. So if it's money to meet your spending needs over the next 2 to 3 years, I'd really caution anyone from taking additional risk with that money. I think if it's a longer-term proposition, so it's going to be money that's used later in the future, say more than 3 years, I think that's where you can start having the conversation about, okay, are there some other alternatives here that might make sense to take on a little bit more risk, understanding the risk and return trade-off. You can't have anything for free, so if you want a little bit more return, you have to be willing to take some risk and then look at what those options are. But for short-term money, for money for immediate expenses, I think you have to keep that conservative. And if that means adjusting your spending to come back down to what the income is going to produce, unfortunately, that's really the safe way to do it.
David, would you agree?
Yeah, but what I wanted to come back to is, though, let's talk about the guy that has the $500,000 that he saved.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if he's not lucky enough to have generated a pension in retirement, well, he's got to live off that $500,000. And, you know, Social Security, for the average person out there, Social Security is not enough income to live on.
Right.
So if he's used to getting $25,000 in interest off his money, and now he's only getting $5,000, it's like, what does he do? Does he stop eating? You know, does he, you know, stop taking the newspaper? You know, what does he do? And so it does become a really complex question of, okay, how do we make that up? And if you really have to have the money, you're going to have to take that risk. And so these are the kind of conversations we're having with clients on a regular basis to try to bridge that gap. And it's not an easy solution.
Well, quickly, that same $500,000 lucky individual to have $500,000, and if he doesn't want to take the risk, maybe he just uses part of that corpus of the $500,000
mm-hmm.
in the almost zero instrument that he finds himself in now, waiting for yields to come back up, because they will. They're coming back. It's just a matter of time, and they will come back to more historical levels. But maybe just using some of that corpus, knowing that if he doesn't want to entertain risk.
What's a corpus? Is that the principal?
Well, that's the $500,000.
Excuse me. Yeah, yeah, the principal.
Principal.
We
thank
all
you.
Knew that. 235-2888 is the phone number, 816-235-2888. You can send us an email, centralstandard@kcur.org. The Cash Money Crew is here with certified financial planners Lewis Butchell, David Jackson, and Alex Petrovic. Maybe you're a small investor. Maybe you just started. Maybe you have your first job. And you might not have a heavy-duty income, but you know, they say the earlier you start, the better off you are once you reach retirement. I think we can help you. 235-2888. At least that's my approach, David.
Oh, absolutely. You know,
right?
You know, the younger you are. And, you know, Alex already touched on it. The stock market is having a great year. And, you know, sometimes we get caught up in the headlines. And, you know, we hear a lot of negatives about the economy in the headlines.
Yeah.
But the stock market is actually having a great year. For the younger person who's exposed to the stock market, they should be really happy.
Well, let's say I'm fresh out of college, first job. A relatively low income. I can give you $150 a month. I don't have a lump sum to give you.
Right.
Just we can start off on a monthly payment. Where would you put me? And we'll go around the studio with this with an answer.
Who wants to start?
Why don't you, David?
Okay.
Yeah.
It kind of depends because, you know, with that $150 a month, it's like, when do you want to start benefiting from that money? So is this retirement money or is this money that you're putting away to make a down payment on a house? Or, you know, so we have to start with that. But let's assume that it's long-term money.
Uh-huh.
Then I'm going to suggest the guy maybe invest in an aggressive mutual fund that invests in the stock market.
Okay.
You know, give his money time to accumulate and compound. And, you know, over time, that's going to build into something.
And at the same time, should this person be setting aside some money for emergency situations? And
yeah, absolutely.
A little more
so
of a conservative position?
That's why it's such a difficult question to answer because there's so many different components. It's like the first thing I may tell him is, you know, you need to make sure you have adequate insurance. And, you know, if you got a family, you know, you need life insurance. Maybe you need some disability also. So it just kind of depends. But if we're just thinking about from the investment standpoint, a young person. And I want to bring this up because with young people, they have never really seen a really strong bull market, you know. So they started thinking about the stock market. They saw what happened in 2001
right.
with the dot-com collapse, and they saw 2008, and it's like, why would anybody invest their money?
Yeah.
But for long-term growth on your money, you have to get your money invested.
Alex, what would you do?
Yeah, I agree with all of what David had said, and I would just add to that. We start off with a risk tolerance questionnaire to get a feel for their appetite or not for risk assets. And but then sometimes we override the results of that by explaining to them if they are young and this is long-term money, especially if they're in a tax savings account at the university or, you know, at their corporations, that it's a good way long-term to make money. The only one caution is if a first-time investor starts off real aggressive and they fail to make any money because it's a bear market, then that's their first experience. So sometimes we'll start off more of a balanced approach fund, let's say a half stock, half bond or something, so that they have some good experiences so that they don't get burnt right up front, even though they've got 40 years to retirement. But those first experiences can, you know, taint their outlook long term. And then we want to own something. That's where you make money, by owning something. You own the bank or you invest in the bank. If it's a good bank long term, you're going to make money owning that bank.
And the two biggest institutional investors in the stock market, correct me if I'm mistaken, the banking industry and the insurance industry, correct?
Institutionally wise, I would guess that's true. I mean, they have their huge stake. They're dependent on it, and they invest. You know, a bank that takes your money is investing in a combination of real estate, bonds, stocks. I mean, really, when you come down to the bottom, that's really the only thing to really invest in.
Uh-huh.
I mean, and it's a derivative of each of those from there on.
Lucas, what would you do with that person's $150?
I think it's just kind of carrying on the conversation. It's with the assumption that it's long-term retirement money and having a conversation with the individual about their appetite for risk. Generally speaking, though, as a young investor, you have the time horizon to be able to take the risk that comes with a portfolio that's heavy in equities. And that's generally what I would recommend, if assuming they were comfortable with the risk. You know, I think that gives them the most long-term growth prospects, and it really, starting early and being able to have good growth in your portfolio, it really sets you apart and gives you a great head start for retirement. So that's what I would do. The thing that, to Alex's point about if you have a bad experience up front, the natural indication is then to try to start timing the market in and out. And that's a strategy that just doesn't work.
Right.
So that's why risk tolerance is important, is it? Because if you can't stomach the losses and you freak out when the market's down, you can really hurt yourself permanently by selling out and then not getting back in.
Is it true that if you isolate any 10-year period in the stock market, that you will have earned, I think the average used to be 7 years, but I don't know after the couple of crashes that we experienced in the early 2000s.
I think what you're asking, and I'm going to make an assumption.
Yeah.
We used to be able to say that in any 10-year period that you looked at in history.
Yeah, you take any 10 years.
Yeah, the stock market had never lost money. That's no longer true now because now if you take, I think it was from 2001 to 2011, that 10-year period did lose some money. I think that's what you're
That is
towards.
Really what I was asking. Yeah, thanks. Yeah. Thanks for helping me out, bailing me out there. Let's go to the phone lines, and Anita joins us from Kansas City. Good morning. Anita? Well,
where'd Anita go?
Hopefully she'll call back. Brent's joining us from Kansas City. Hi, Brent.
Hello. My question is, at what point did the stock market go from, you know, initially when people put money in the stock market, it would go for capital improvements, like to, you know, buy another ship, to make factory improvements, and now the stock money is no longer used for that. It's just used to leverage better loans from banks. At what point in history did it change?
Brent, I think this is Alex. I think I know the question, but there are really two different purposes of the stock market. First off, an original IPO where companies issue stock, that money that they raise from issuing new stock goes generally either to pay down debt or to expand by buying new rolling stock and so forth. After stocks have been issued and trade on the exchange, then that's just people exchanging existing shares, and in large part is not really funding anything, if that's the nature of his question.
Yeah, it is. And to me, then it you know, I'm not a socialist or a communist, but to me it just seems like such a bizarre concept of watching a company go, you know, watch their stock tank for not a lot of real reason other than speculation or fear, and then all this money just disappears. Or like, say, GM needs to build a new plant, they just get a loan instead of, you know, 300 years ago, the money would basically, they would take the money from their stocks to do that, from what I understand. And I'm just curious, when it became pure money making money with no service, no capital, no product, I mean, with nothing provided other than, in my view, imaginary numbers.
Lucas, why don't you jump in
here? Sure. Brent, a stock always has been a piece of ownership in a company. And that's really what you get today when you buy a stock on the stock market, on the exchange, is you buy a very small sliver ownership in that particular company. That entitles you to certain things like assets if the company were to liquidate, and most importantly, a stream of the profits moving forward. And that's what you buy with a stock. Now, the price of that stock is going to go up and down based on some of the things you mentioned, speculation, feelings of the market. But really, long term, it comes to what are the expectations for that company's future profitability and the ability to grow their profits. That's what drives stock prices in the long term. In the short term, it can be any wide variety of things and can be irrational, to your point.
But what I also hear Brent talking about is he's kind of alluding to a lack of confidence, a lack of trust in the stock market. And I think that's widely shared given all the shenanigans that have taken place in the past decade.
Well, you know, when people think about the stock market, they're thinking about this broad concept that they really don't understand. But if you said, I own Walmart, you know, as an example.
Mm-hmm.
I'm the owner of Walmart.
Mm-hmm.
You wouldn't consider yourself in some high-risk speculative investment. You'd say, hey, I'm the owner of Walmart. My last name's Walton, and I make a lot of money. You know, so people, you know, if you demystify the stock market, that's all it is owning companies.
Mm-hmm.
I would agree, though, what it sounded like part of Brent's conversation was, is that because of there's been so much, corruption, and it's always going to happen. I mean, we run a pretty good ship in America in terms of regulations compared to a lot of other countries. But we've had our fair share of it, and it keeps popping up. And I think part of the frustration here recently is, I say recently, maybe 10 years, is that there has been a lot of corruption, and very few people pay the price for that when they got caught.
Yeah.
And I think there's a lot of people that are frustrated with that.
Yeah. Well, and there's something like 80 million people in America participating in the stock market on some level, and most are just people like us sitting at this table.
Yeah, the people kind of feel like maybe it's rigged.
Yeah, and I feel that anger myself at times.
Yep, I do think it is important here that we're talking about kind of yield and interest rates, and stocks definitely are one alternative to that. If an individual is willing to take on some risk, stocks are an option. Dividend-paying stocks, so these are typically bigger companies that have steady cash flows, are willing to, pay out a dividend every year or every quarter, and that can be a supplement to income. It also gives you the growth prospects of that stock. But one thing it also exposes you to is the ups and downs of the stock market that we're talking about. But that is a solution for somebody that is looking for yield, also has the appetite to take a little bit of risk and is willing to kind of take those ups and downs with a company that's or a basket of companies that's willing to pay a dividend on a quarterly basis.
Let's go back to the phone calls, and joining us from Mission is Maria. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm calling I'm a younger investor, and so going back to that topic, I was curious about the perspective of the folks that are there this morning. If I don't have a lot of money to invest, and I'm putting it towards my retirement every year, I also know that there is a certain amount of that that's used as a management fee. So I'm curious what the tipping point is between when it's time to go get a financial advisor and when it makes more sense to simply keep sort of tucking money away until I have a big chunk of money I can give to an advisor and say, okay, let's start investing together.
Who wants to handle that?
Yeah, that's David? One of the interesting things about our industry is that, financial advisors, we do get paid. And small investors are really hard for us to make any money off of. This is the world we live in. So she makes such a valid point, that, and there's not a simple answer to that either. Because what I would like to see happen, if I were king and I could make the rules, is that employers, companies, would sponsor financial advisors to come into each company and say, educate my employees on how to manage their money and how to invest their money. Because she makes a valid point. As a young person without a whole lot of money, who does she go to get advice? She can read money magazines or listen to the radio, but without a little bit of a portfolio, it's kind of hard to work with a financial advisor.
But let me ask you this. Let me just be real pointed about this. Would you work with Maria?
Actually, I do. I do work with Maria's.
Okay.
I do have those as part of my book of business, and it's kind of just my attitude about wanting to help people as much as I can. So I do have probably more than I should people like Maria.
My question is certainly, I appreciate all those responses, but my question is, at what point do I have enough assets to warrant going and engaging the services of a financial advisor and a financial planner?
Yeah, Maria, this is Alex. I think David, his attempt was, and I thought I heard it, but it's saying that he would work for you to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
And there would be some sort of small fee attached to it. But don't either, whether you work with him or you go out on your own, in a sense, the real most important thing is saving money. And then if it's long-term money, investing it in good investments. And you can do that on your own to begin with. What happens later, though, is when you accumulate a large nest egg, then the emotional part plays in the ups and downs of the market. And I think for our industry, those three of us sitting around here that come here today, part is managing those expectations, those emotions. When we get paid the best, we really earn our keep when the market's down.
Yeah.
Right now, we're up 26% on the S&P. We're not earning our keep because it's easy. But when the market's down, trying to get people not to make bad decisions then is probably when we get paid the best. But
and Maria, the advice I would give you, if only because I've been around this planet for a lot of years, unfortunately, I'm a very old man, is that no matter what you do, make sure you're involved with your financial planner. You need to know exactly what he or she is doing with your money, and you need to know what the fees are. You need to know, you need to be really engaged in the process. You're like, it's like having a workout partner. It's like the buddy system when you go swimming. It really is.
Okay. And as a small investor, is my financial planner really going to give me the time and attention that, you know, if I'm only investing $150 a month, you know, it's hard to feel like I'm going to justify that time and be regarded get the respect, I guess, I'm hoping to get.
Lucas?
Even though I don't have a $500,000 portfolio.
Yeah. Yep.
And I think you're right on it. And it comes back to some of the things that David said about, you know, as a business owner, as a financial planner, you know, the thing you're trying to do, number one, is stay in business. And you know, you have to make decisions about, you know, appointments and those things in part based on that. But I think if you find the right financial advisor that'll help you get a good strategy to start, I think they can get you on a good path help you along the way.
When we return from a break, we'll go to Grandview and we'll talk to Jack. The Cash Money crew is here for their monthly visit. We're talking about volatility in the markets, how you can protect yourself and establish strategies that'll help your savings and help your retirement plans. Our phone line is open at 816-235-2888. We welcome your questions and experiences and brief comments. We'll talk more after this break. I'm Bill Anderson. This is Central Standard on KCUR and KCUR.org. Welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Bill Anderson. We're talking to the Cash Money crew about bonds, yields, your savings, ways to move forward in a market that's a bit trying. And we're looking for incentives for you to help you save your money, protect your money. And we can assist you whether you're young or old, new or veteran in your investment practices. Maybe you have a question. Phone us now at 816-235-2888. Our email address, centralstandard@kcur.org. David Jackson is here. He's a financial planner with Waddell & Reed. Alex Petrovic is a certified financial planner at Petrovic Financial Services. Lucas Butchel is here. He serves the same role with KHC Wealth Management. Lucas, get us back on track. Let's go back to the bond market. Let's talk about yields and ways that we can kind of thrive or at least survive in this weird market.
Absolutely. So, you know, there are some other options out there outside of savings accounts and CDs that do offer some higher yields. And the trade-off there is taking on a little bit or a bit more risk. You know, some of the things that would be available are bonds. And the longer the maturity of the bond, the higher the yield. So that's an option. There's different types of bonds that are higher risk that pay higher yields. Those can be really rewarding and as a basket of investments can help provide a good yield and have a modest level of risk.
Such as?
High yield bonds that you can buy those in the I'd most likely do that in a mutual fund format. So they're going to be companies that are a little bit lower rated from a credit risk standpoint, but investors are compensated by getting a higher yield, such as 3%, 4%, or 5%, and historically those are even higher.
Are you talking about junk bonds?
Yes, that'd be another name for.
Yeah.
For but in a basket, you know, the failure rate of those companies actually are really low right now and have been. So buying one junk bond is probably a bad idea. Buying a basket of hundreds or thousands of those bonds in a mutual fund format can be a really good piece of a diversified bond portfolio.
And remind us what a junk bond is, essentially.
It's a bond that's got a credit rating lower than, I believe, BBB. And so what that is, it's a rating agency looks at the company and their dynamics and numbers, and they assign a rating to them. So these are companies that you may have fallen on hard times and are bouncing back. You know, there's a variety of reasons they can have a lower rating, but
it's not necessarily bad management. It might be like a heavy debt load or something like that.
It could be one of a variety of things. You know, heavy debt load. They're reinventing their business. Maybe core business lines have been obsolete, or you know, Sprint. I believe I'm not sure if they are today, but I know they have been. You're in that junk status. So, I think they. There definitely are some named companies you would recognize that have junk bond status debt. So it sounds risky, but I think there's ways to do it where you can manage that risk.
I see.
It's definitely a way where you can get a higher yield. There's other options with international bonds that have higher yields. And then there's some unique options like a master limited partnership in the energy industry is a nice fixed income opportunity and an alternative that folks are talking more and more about these days.
Okay, David?
Well, you know, one of the things I wanted to come back to was when we're talking about this low interest rate environment, I just wanted to mention if you're earning, let's just say, 0.5% interest on, say, a CD or something like that, you are technically losing money.
Mm-hmm.
So even though a person has this money with a guaranteed interest rate and they think, well, at least my money's safe, well, you're guaranteeing that you're losing money, because if the inflation rate is running at 1.5%, 2%, and you're only earning 0.5% on your money, You're going backwards. So that's kind of the dilemma that people are facing right now of, you know, earning basically nothing and the cost of everything else is going up. So that's why people need to be looking at what alternatives are out there. And then we also are in an environment which really gets interesting. So the next level from guaranteed interest is Lucas is describing, bonds, investing in the fixed income market.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what happens with bonds generally is when interest rates go up, the value of bonds goes down.
Right.
We're at an all-time low on interest rates right now, which means what direction can they go up? If it's already as low as it can possibly be, eventually interest rates are going to start going back up. And so
one would think.
Yeah. So people who are saying, okay, I need to maybe move out of the guaranteed interest of my savings account into bonds, they may be setting themselves up for failure in the coming years, because as interest rates start going up, they may be taking a bath because the returns on bonds will go down. So we're in a very complex environment right now. And maybe not people like Maria who called in, but people that are older, they would benefit from talking to a financial advisor to find out what options are out there. And, you know, we all preach diversification. And, you know, I think right now being diversified is probably the best thing you can do for yourself to try to minimize those risks.
The bond market, it seems like we're in an unprecedented place with the bond market. I remember it was always considered kind of a safe haven. You know, you're right. Guaranteed. You might not make a ton of money in the bond market, but it was almost guaranteed that you would generate some income from it. And it's so volatile now. It's just so wacky.
Yeah. Well, I would add that, first off, some statistics.
Yeah.
The 6-month CDs earn about 0.1%. A 5-year CD is even still less than 1%. So we would say don't buy a 5-year CD, lock your money up for that long. But some perspective for the last 13 years about another set of statistics. The bond index that we use in our industry, the Barclays Capital, so just call it the S&P of the bond market, last 13 years averaged 5%. The S&P during that same time frame did 6.5.
Okay.
The 6-month CD rate for those, that'd be 11 years for all of these, was 2.1. So this isn't as new an environment that we might think.
Okay.
So for 11 years, a 6-month CD has averaged 2%. So the savers have had this dilemma now for some time. And I look at it a little bit different. If the client has the perspective to do this, is that a total return portfolio? That's a combination of bonds, cash, diversified stocks. So in this environment, we got the S&P up 20%, and the bond market down 2%. So we're year to date. If you had a 50-50 portfolio of just two broad indices, you know, you're still up 10%. And if your cash needs are 5, you know, then even though your bond market is suffering this year, your stocks are carrying you through. So on a total return portfolio, you take pieces off instead of trying to be so specific that my bonds are just for income and my stocks are for later. So the total return concept is one that we basically use in terms of, you know, drawing money out of clients' retirement portfolios.
Lucas.
Yep, and just to add on to that, I think the bond area of portfolios is an area that has a lot more risk than perceived. So your point, and it's very very consistent with what a lot of folks think, is, you know, bonds feel like a safe, guaranteed investment. They absolutely are not. You can have price fluctuations, which we've been talking about. And also, inherently, if you buy a bond and the company fails, you won't get paid back 100%. You may not get paid back anything. So they've never been, quote-unquote, safe. They've been less volatile and less bumpy than stocks, which is why they kind of get that reputation. And then one other just quick piece of advice. I think you know, investors that are kind of looking for more yield, looking for more return, may get tempted to go with longer-term bonds. I think the bonds with longer maturities, I think there's a real trap there with in a rising interest rate environment, which I feel like we are in or are definitely moving forward into. The price on those can get hit significantly when we have rates go up. So I would really caution investors that are looking at their bonds and bond alternatives to be really careful about investing in long-term bonds.
Mekadam has a question about middle-aged investors. Hey, good morning.
Hi, good morning, David. How are you?
Mikadam, you back in town?
Yes, I'm back in town. How are you?
Hey, good to hear from you.
Good to hear from you, you know. I got a question, David, and I don't have your number, but I would like to get you in touch with you. And what do you have any other plan for middle-aged investors, you know, which is like my age, you know, which is 47 to 50? You said earlier about the younger generation, they should start earlier. But what the middle age, you know, what will be the right age and what will be the right amount to enough to be retired?
Good question.
Yeah, and I'm going to frame this with Mikadam as a successful business owner from Ethiopia, and a really classy guy. But anyway, I've known Mikadam for years. But for a 50-year-old, I'd go back to what Alex was saying with looking at the total returns concept. A balanced portfolio with a mix of stocks and bonds might be most appropriate. The risk, or not the risk, but the issue that you have to deal with as a middle-aged portfolio is that you're making up for lost time. You know, if a young person who invests early and they accumulate money, they've already built up a big nest egg. Somebody in their middle age, they've got to make up for lost time, so they have to maybe put a lot more money in per month or per year to make up for that lost time.
Do you have a follow-up?
Yes, I do have, but I would like to get your number and want to contact you again. So,
am I allowed to give him my number?
Well, what we'll do is we'll put him on hold, and our producer will get that number to him.
All right, appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks for calling in.
Yeah, thank you, sir. Let's go to Bill. Before we go to Bill, actually, I want to ask you a question, and this is an email from Gabby in Kansas City. Can you explain the reverse mortgage as an investment? Is that a wise thing to do, or are there so many considerations and factors that could sway that response?
Yeah, this is Alex. On a high level, they serve their purpose for people that are just basically older and really don't have cash, but they have equity in their home. They can be a legitimate option. You should be very careful, though, before you do it.
Mm-hmm.
But they certainly can be an option for cash-strapped older people with equity in their home.
Cash-strapped people. Okay. Yep. So it's not necessarily a dangerous move to make.
No, you get to live there, and you get a certain amount of money cash back, and then they're basically giving you a return of your principal.
Okay. Let's go to Bill is joining us from Kansas City, Missouri. Hi, Bill.
Good morning. My question, I'd like to maybe poll your three panelists about peer-to-peer lending, what they know about that, and how that works, and just general information about it.
Yeah. Lucas?
You know, I think it's definitely a new phenomenon. Basically, what it is there's websites now where you have the ability to go out, and if you're looking for money, you can kind of put your profile out there and ask for a loan, and then, you know, the website and the organization will kind of rate it, and then investors can come on and, you know, make loans in very small increments, $50 or up, based on the interest rate that you'd be paying on that. So it's really, you know, kind of playing the bank, kind of being an intermediary that plays the bank and allows investors to participate, and then allows people that need money to borrow it. I think it's such a new concept, and to be honest with you, I haven't had a lot of direct experience with it, but I've read about it, and I think the it's a very interesting model. And I think as if you wanted to participate in that, I'd say I'd do it. I'd do it on a very small level to start, and check it out. I just think we don't have enough water under the bridge yet to know, are these reputable companies? How good is the rating system? All of those things.
Is it regulated by the Securities Exchange Commission?
I do not believe so, but okay. I don't know that for a fact.
Alex?
We've had instances or examples of an existing client where someone needed to borrow money. It was a younger person in a family, and they went to their parents or grandparents, and they lend them the money, and the parents were making zero on their money, and they negotiated a loan that was maybe in the 2-3 or 4%, where the parent ended up getting real cash flow from a trusted family member. So it could be the peer-to-peer could be family members.
Yeah, I was at church recently, which is going to be a surprise to a lot of people.
how you qualify it, recently.
it was at a Methodist church, and they had their own microloan program through the church for people who, just needed some immediate cash infusion, where they could just borrow it. Instead of going to the payday loan kind of places, they go through the church and get a reasonable interest rate. I thought that was really good to see.
Good luck to you, Bill.
Okay, thanks very much.
Yeah. You're listening to KCUR. This is Central Standard. I'm Bill Anderson. With us in the studio this morning, the Cash Money crew, Alex Petrovic, Lewis Butchell, and David Jackson. And, of course, we invite your phone calls, and I believe Russ is joining us. Hi, Russ.
Hi. I'm trying to keep this specific and short. It's kind of complicated. A lot of these large companies buy up other companies and kind of collect name brands, and in the process, they neglect companies until they essentially allow them to die on the vine. Well, we purchased a former Fortune 500 company that was producing well that they just allowed to die, and we got it for nothing, essentially. And the day we opened the door, it was profitable. Huh. All of our income coming in has gone to recapitalize the business. And my question is, you spoke a little bit about it just a second ago, is why is it that people feel a need to send their money out of the area into the stock market where other people use their money and the incentive is to spend it, speculate with it, steal it, as opposed to investing locally with a business that they can stop by, look at their investment, keep tabs on it, and stimulate the local economy and avoid a lot of the pitfalls of these big corporations? So I'd really like some feedback on this, because the whole stock market idea has never made sense to me. And I've had businesses since I was 10 at all. I'm just curious why people aren't investing in local businesses.
Hey, Russ, let me ask you before we get an answer from the panel. So are you saying you're not in the stock market at all?
No, not at all. And we generally make 550 to 1,000% our investment, always have. And I don't understand people being satisfied with 5% or 10% or 100%. I mean, we produce actual products, and we find stuff that other people have overlooked. I mean, it's just opportunities are laying everywhere. During the recession, we tripled our business. And it's all legal. It's just hard work and being sharp and looking at opportunities when they come up. And the problem we've run into is we've had more opportunities than actual available cash flow to capitalize all of them. We have this huge, huge, everything paid for, inventory, equipment, buildings, properties, and we're reluctant to go to banks because of all the constraints they want to put on you on lending, and we're also reluctant to go into the stock market in terms of offering stock options because we're so diverse. We're not really sure how to compact this into, quote, a stock.
Yeah.
Understand what I'm saying?
Well, Russ, let's get a response from the gentleman in the studio this morning.
No, I would say that, first off, congratulations. But number two, not all of those stories are successful of people that are around this town and other towns raising money, whether it's private equity or just people gathering money. There's all sorts of horror stories where people invest and lose money from people that say they're going to make them a lot of money. So that's both sides of the coin, whether it's a large corporations like, WorldCom that went bust, or Apple that made it big, or privately companies locally that do really good or go bust. So, I mean, it's buyer beware.
Uh-huh.
So whether it's locally or nationally.
I remember hearing about maybe 7 or 8 years ago, you couldn't lose money in real estate. It's like real estate's one thing that you can't fail in. I mean, so there's risk in everything.
Yeah.
Just have to take it with a grain of salt.
Yeah.
Yep, and the one question I would have had for the caller is,
well, he's still here.
Oh, great!
So,
every parent to lend it to every kid.
Yeah, I think one of the things that's a struggle with these private equity type deals is you know there's a hurdle rate to get in. You know, what's the minimum to get in? And then if that's all you have, you're kind of putting everything in with this one equity deal. And if it does fall on hard times, like Alex talked about, you know, you're concentrated in a bad investment. So I guess there is a question on the table: is you know what does it take to get into yours or something like yours?
Russ, do you have a quick response?
Well, I guess my response would be if someone came to me and said, look, I have $200,000 I want to invest, and I want 10% return per year on it, and let me look at your books. I got to be open. I want to see your operation. I'd be open to that because I could easily make money with their money, and I could make them money, and we could expand our capitalization as well. We could do so. It could be a very personal, hands-on type situation, which is the nature of all our businesses. We made money in real estate during the recession. Yeah. I mean, so it's just, you're right, you do take risks out there, but I think if you develop relationships with people, good business relationships, that you can get a sense of what's honest and fair and will work and what won't.
Well, thanks for the phone call. Good contribution this morning.
Well, thank you very much for taking it. I appreciate it.
Let's talk a little bit about, let me throw a couple of things at you here as alternatives or as options in this crazy market. A stable value fund. What exactly is that? Is that a question for you, Alex?
Well, I'll try. Stable value funds typically are CD-like investments in retirement plans. That's primarily where they're available. And they're basically a fixed annuity that has a floating interest rate. And they've been really good options. There have been occasionally some problems with them, like all investments. But by and large, if you're at a good institution, one of the major institutions that provide this in their retirement plans, it's a viable option. We've used it for recommending it to clients to utilize that as a bond surrogate or cash surrogate in their 401ks, primarily where you see it.
And I also want to mention before we ran out of time the value of using an annuity in some instances. So let's go back to the guy with the $500,000 that we started the show with, and he's getting this 5% interest off of his CD that he's been living on all these years. Possibly if he had used that very same money and invested in certain types of annuities, he could have guaranteed his income stream for the rest of his life and not have to worry about this drop in interest rates reducing his income. So not in all instances, but in a lot of instances, annuities can make a lot of sense to replace somebody who doesn't have a pension plan to get guaranteed income for life.
Alex.
Yeah, I definitely agree with, but the timing is also important. And we're in an environment right now that I really believe that it's not the greatest time to buy into annuities. That time will come, and we had a time that it was attractive. It's kind of like the bond market. You know, maybe it isn't so attractive right now. It will be later. But annuities are a great option. I just think that the yields, but the problem is if you invest in annuities, this is broadly speaking, presently, you're pretty much locking yourself into these low rates because they have the same problem as investors do.
Well, I think you're describing a fixed annuity, and there's variable annuities that offer the lifetime income option where you can guarantee your income off of that for life. So
but
there are different
types. Those also are at historic lows in terms of the fees on them are higher now, and the guarantees on the lifetime income are lower. There will be a time that we should address that. I personally just think it's not a good time. And then one final thing, really quick, I wanted to address Lucas's earlier about the risk of the bond market. And there is a risk in the bond market. But with that said, it's about a quarter at best the risk of the stock market. So when you look at it historically, the risks are far less. You're going to, peak to trough in 07 to 09 for the S&P was in the 50s, minus 50s. Of course, the bond markets rallied through that. But peak to trough, I don't know what the peak to trough historically would be on a downside of the bond market, but it is nowhere near that. Because pensions, endowments, insurance companies, banks, conservative investors, the need and the desire for bonds is only temporarily tempered. They're gonna hold their own, and there's more bonds issued by capitalization in the world. I don't know if it's two times whatever than stocks. So it's an entity that's not going away. It may be just a little out of favor.
I definitely agree. I think there's a place for bonds in most portfolios. I think there's some pitfalls, especially with long-term bonds that investors looking for yield need to be aware of currently. But I think long-term and in a diversified portfolio strategy, yes, I mean, bonds have a place for sure.
How about a floating rate bond?
A floating rate bond or a bond fund is a fund that's got a rate that floats with rising interest rates. So it's an attractive option to get maybe a little higher yield now and also a yield that should move up as rates move up.
I don't think we're going to be able to put her on the phone here, but Katie is calling from Kansas City and has a question about social responsible investing. And she basically is asking, what is it?
Social responsible investing is it's a strategy that you have some folks will use, and really what they're looking to do is invest in companies that have some sort of a rating that they're socially responsible, good. It can vary dramatically by who's calling them socially responsible and good, and they evaluate policies. So, you know, whether they're in clean energy or they have good employment practices, all of those things. But it's basically a selection criteria over and above. Just it's a stock with a company that does certain things.
Yeah, trying to avoid like tobacco or firearms, mm-hmm. things like that.
And I might match it to my values.
Right.
Okay. That's what I presume. In the brief amount of time that we have, let's quickly go around the studio and kind of, you know, if you only had one piece of advice to give me right now, Lucas, what would it be?
You can't get anything for free. So if you're looking for yield and you see something that's really, really looks great, be cautious because, there's some inherent risks there and don't be mesmerized by something that looks too good to be true.
David?
I would just recommend people stay diversified because you never know what's going to do well when. If you've got a well-balanced, diversified portfolio, you'll capitalize.
Alex?
Yeah, well, you can't change the direction of the wind, but you can tilt your investments to favor what looks attractive enough for your risk level.
I want to thank our guests, the Cash Money Crew, this month comprised of David Jackson from Waddell & Reed, Alex Petrovic of Petrovic Financial Services, and Lewis Butchell of KCH Wealth Management. Subscribe to our podcast, hear this conversation again, or access any of the archive shows at the Central Standard page of KCUR.org. Join us tomorrow for a conversation with a local documentary filmmaker and an author with a new portrait of Karl Marx. Our show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton with help from Ross Steinmetz and Sangeeta Shastri. Up to date with guest host, the incomparable Randy Mason of KCPT, and he'll have a conversation about summer suffering. I'm Bill Anderson. It's a privilege to join you this morning. Take care.